Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out.
Hello and welcome back to New Books in History, the channel of the New Books Network. I'm your host, Zeb Larson, and we're here today with Dr. Heather Curtis of Tufts University to discuss her book, Holy Humanitarians, American Evangelicals and Global Aid. Dr. Curtis analyzes the Christian Herald, an interdenominational newspaper which became one of the leading coordinators of international humanitarian assistance in the United States in the late 19th and early 20th centuries. By focusing on this newspaper and the men who ran it, Dr. Curtis sheds light on the history of international humanitarian relief in the United States, debates over the role that evangelicals should play in public life, and the identity of the United States as a Christian nation in an era of uncertainty and change. Dr. Curtis, welcome to the New Books Network. Tell us a little bit about yourself and where you went to school.
Zeb, thank you so much for having me on. It's a real privilege to be able to talk about my work. So I started my education at the University of Virginia with an interdisciplinary major in political and social thought. And for that, I wrote an undergraduate thesis on human rights and the transition to democracy in Latin America. And that reflected sort of a driving interest of mine in ethics and international human rights law. I also was interested in medical ethics. So I had this driving question early on about how people deal with various forms of suffering. And eventually, I thought I was going to be an ethicist or an international human rights lawyer, but eventually I found my path to answering the questions I had through history. So I think about myself now as a scholar who writes about the history of ethics, and asked how human beings in the past have dealt with ethical dilemmas, various forms of suffering. So to get there, I first pursued a master's degree in theology, followed by a doctorate in the history of Christianity from Harvard, where I focus my research in American religious history. And during that period of time, I was really captivated. My broader training in the history of Christianity led me to stories of medieval Christian saints who were venerated for their suffering, right? The imitation of Christ. And the question arose for me, how did Christianity transition from a religion with suffering at its center to one that in some contemporary American expressions, such as the one sort of embraced by Donald Trump and many of his key religious advisors, proclaims that Christianity promises health and wealth, right? Sickness and pain are only for those who don't have enough faith or who aren't good enough. So that sort of set of questions led me to my first book, which was about faith healing. And it asked how Christians have made sense of and coped with suffering in their own bodies. And it focused on late 19th century. I'm happy to say more about that if you want to hear about it. But out of that book came a curiosity about the book that we're talking about today, how Christians have made sense of and coped with the suffering of others, and how and why has that changed over time. So that's a quick background of how I went from an undergraduate interdisciplinary major in political and social theory to a PhD in the history of religion, and now two different books that I think of as books about the history of ethics focused on questions about how Christians in particular in the United States have dealt with both personal suffering and various kinds of suffering outside of themselves.
Well, that's a nice, actually sort of clear trajectory right to this particular book. I'm curious, was there a specific impetus that brought you to Holy Humanitarians, or was it a topic you'd sort of been aware of and wanted to work on before this?
Yeah, so the first book, The Faith in the Great Physician, which is about the late 19th century divine healing movement, many of the characters in that book claimed to experience dramatic healing and insisted that they had been restored to health in order to do God's work in the world. So for women in particular, this involved becoming usually missionaries, and quite a few of them, the characters in that first book, went overseas to places like Armenia and India in the 1880s and 90s, where they very soon encountered suffering on a massive scale in the form of, in Armenia, political violence, or natural disasters like the Great India Famines of the 1890s. And so I knew about those encounters, and I was curious to know how these individuals who had experienced healing on their own made sense of and coped with suffering, the suffering of others. And I wanted to know, like, how they translated the sort of personal into the social. So that led me to start looking at a lot of missionary archives and trying to think about the various organizations in the late 19th century that were thinking about suffering in international context, but also domestically, places like the YMCA or city missions movements. And one of the archives that I worked extensively in early on was the Day Missions Library at Yale University. And I found in one of the sets of papers there reference to an orphanage in China during the early 20th century that was sponsored by an organization called the Christian Herald. And I thought, what's that? And that's how it led me down to the path to this book, which eventually I started off with this huge scope, right? All different missionaries, all different kinds of organizations, to then discovering that the Christian Herald Association was an organization that still existed. It's still has some ministries in New York City. The most prominent one is the Bowery Mission, which is a homeless shelter and soup kitchen in the Bowery, Lower East Side. And I started looking into the history of that organization, and particularly a newspaper that the organization published in the late 19th century that was focused on, in part, relieving suffering both at home and abroad. And the more I read it, the more I got fascinated by the content and found that the story of this organization really hadn't been told. And the more I researched it, the more I thought it was worth knowing about. So that's how I ended up with this particular book and focusing on the main story of this Christian Herald organization and the characters who were at the head of it.
Wonderful. So let's dive into your first chapter then. That's kind of the perfect introduction. Christian Herald, who founded it? What was the intent behind its founding?
Okay, so a couple things to say about the Christian Herald. I'm assuming most people that I talk to about the book, whether it's now on this program or even during the research process, have never heard of it, right? It's not a household name. The two major characters, the proprietor, the owner of the newspaper, Lewis Klopsch, and his editorial partner, a minister named Thomas DeWitt Talmage. It's possible some people have heard of Talmage, but most people have never heard of either of them or the newspaper they ran. And on the contrary, if I were to say, have you heard of Clara Barton and the American Red Cross? Most people say, yes, of course. Or John D. Rockefeller and the Rockefeller Association. Most people say, of course. So that was part of the goal of my project, was to say that if you actually look at the 1890s, early 20th century, the Christian Herald was an extremely important vehicle for fostering faith-based humanitarian aid abroad and philanthropy at home, and in fact rivaled, even outshined, the accomplishments of competing organizations like the Red Cross or early on the Carnegie and Rockefeller Foundation. So part of the introduction to the book is making the case, right, that why is it important to know this story to hear about the lives and work of Lewis Klopsch and Thomas DeWitt Talmage, even though they haven't been, they're not major figures in the history of philanthropy or humanitarianism. So the introduction really sets out, like, here's what the forgotten story is. Here's how the Christian Herald set out to try to get American Protestants interested in the suffering of others, both within American cities as well as overseas, and really makes the case for the fact that this was an influential movement that did involve a vast number of people, the American public, in humanitarian enterprises from the time Klopsch purchased the magazine in the 1890s until his death in 1910. So the introduction sets that stage. It introduces the newspaper, the main characters, tries to establish their importance for the history of American humanitarianism, talks about how successful the publication was in gaining subscribers, talks about its interdenominational audience and international scope. And yeah, just that's my goal in doing that, to get, introduce people to what the Christian Herald was, which I can say a little bit more about if you think we need to do that.
Well, I'm curious, first of all, what was the tradition of liberal international humanitarianism in the United States prior to the Christian Herald?
Yeah, so there was definitely some episodic concern for, I mean, if we're talking about international humanitarianism in particular, from the founding of the United States, there were awareness campaigns when crises would happen abroad. So one of the good places to look for this for your readers, if sort of a traditional history of American philanthropy abroad, is Merle Curti's classic study. He talks about one of sort of the most the moments at which Americans become activated for concern overseas is the Greek Wars of Revolution for Independence in the 1820s. So Americans get interested in the plight of the Greeks, who they see as fighting for liberty and independence, just as the United, in a similar way that the United States was fighting for liberty from tyranny from Great Britain. So then with the Irish famines of the 1840s and beyond, there were also efforts to try to raise relief to send to Ireland to help famine victims. But there weren't, I think what makes the Christian Herald, as well as the American Red Cross and this late 19th century period important, is that up until this time, there weren't structures in place for raising funds, for delivering aid. There was very, and up these earlier instances, there was debate at the federal level about whether the government had congressional and approval to appropriate monies for international relief. There was no state sponsor. There was no USAID, right? There was no welfare state. So both domestically and internationally, there aren't governmental structures in place to promote either fundraising or aid delivery. So by the late 19th century, you start to have the foundation of these organizations that compete to be the humanitarian arm of the United States foreign policy, right? So the American Red Cross is one. And part of what I argue in the book is that the Christian Herald is also arguing to be sort of the primary agency through which American international aid will occur.
Now, there's a theological question at work here with the Christian Herald, too. You know, there's, what struck me reading this book was the extent to which there seems to be, if not an argument, at least a conversation among American Protestants about the best way to sort of give alms and to bear witness in the world in the 19th and early 20th centuries. Where does the Christian Herald fit into that discussion?
So one of the broader arguments of the book is that the Christian Herald and Lewis Klopsch and Thomas Talmage at its head were interested in humanitarianism and philanthropy. They were concerned about the suffering of others and having American Protestants live out their faith through giving and caring. They were also very concerned about the status of American Protestantism at this time. The 1890s is a time in which what had been a relatively unified American Protestant identity that they equated with the identity of the United States as a Christian nation, that unity was coming under a lot of pressure in the 1890s for theological reasons. This is sort of the era of Darwinism, debates about how to interpret the Bible, whether the Bible is, you know, the inerrant, inspired word of God, or whether or not it has to be also read historically. There were debates about social issues, the influx of Catholic immigrants, and the reunification of the nation post-Civil War. So all kinds of concerns about whether or not American Protestants could maintain what historians call this evangelical united front. And we can talk about the word evangelicalism in a little bit, but for most of the 19th century, it was somewhat synonymous with American Protestantism, right? So Episcopalians, Lutherans, Baptists, Methodists, Presbyterians, Disciples of Christ, all of these groups had specific debates about some points of theology and church policy and organization, but they shared a basic concern for Christianizing America and the United States. And so by the late 19th century, that's starting to fracture. And part of what I argue in the book is that Klopsch and Talmadge see humanitarianism and philanthropy as a way of keeping American Protestantism united, right? If they, so like, let's not talk about who wrote the Pentateuch, who wrote the books of the Bible, but what we do know is that Jesus calls people to help their neighbor. So certainly if we all participate in this common aim and focus on that, we don't have to be focused on these things that are more divisive. And at the same time, they had a vision for how doing that, becoming a charitable, almsgiving nation, could keep the United States explicitly Christian and distinctive, sort of the Redeemer nation idea, at a time when the United States was also becoming more engaged in world affairs. So those are sort of two ways I think that the theological is operating for the Christian Herald. And it becomes increasingly part of the story of the book is that holding that center together becomes increasingly difficult by the time Klopsch dies in 1910. And that's part of the end of the story of why it is that the Christian Herald takes on a different shape in the 20th century.
Mm-hmm. So let's dive into one of those campaigns, and this one comes out of your second chapter. It has to do with the Ottoman Empire, where the Christian Herald is heavily engaged, but sort of almost as time goes on different sides. What's going on in the Ottoman Empire in the 1890s?
Yeah, so the second chapter really tells the story. I think the first chapter sets up, you know, how the Christian Herald originally gets involved in both domestic philanthropy and international aid. And by the early 1890s, 1894, the Christian Herald, Klopsch and Talmadge, really see their newspaper as this instrument of carrying American charity to the world. They have this ethic of the desire to aid what they call all nations, kindreds, peoples, and tongues, right? And that participants in the Christian Herald can engage in charity in order to forge connections with humanity across the world. So their original vision is really quite expansive. They are optimistic about this time period of increasing globalization. They're very aware through the newspaper and all of the missionaries that they correspond to about encounters between American Christians and people of diverse political, ethnic, religious affiliations. And they're hopeful that God's kingdom is being born. That's how they see humanitarianism as a part of that project, right? If we can aid suffering others, this is a way of carrying Christ's message and ultimately bringing about this kingdom of universal peace and goodwill. It's quite stunning, their optimism about all this. So in 1894, there is an earthquake in Constantinople, and they make a huge case for saying this is an opportunity for Americans to do good to brothers and sisters around the world. In Constantinople, there are all kinds of people suffering. And by the way, they hear about this earthquake through missionaries in the ABCFM, the Congregationalist Missionary Board, who write home to them and say, we need help. And the city has been flattened. And so they appeal to their readers and say, we should help. We should help our brothers and sisters in Constantinople. And originally, they have the sense that that includes everyone. It includes the Christians who are present in the region. It also includes the Jewish population in Constantinople, as well as Muslims who've also been affected by the earthquake. And they talk at length in this campaign about how charity should extend to all people, regardless of national, religious, or ethnic affiliation. But then, as I think, as you know, that chapter also charts it early on. They start getting pushback from their readers saying, why should we be sending money to help people who are slaughtering Armenian and persecuting Armenian Christians? So in right around the time of this earthquake is the beginnings of the Hamidian massacres. It's a in which many Armenian Christians are killed in acts of violence. And Klapsch and Talmadge really quickly pivot from this more cosmopolitan ideal of aiding people of any nation, tribe, or tongue, to arguing that even in Constantinople, well, we should still continue the campaign because many Christians are among the victims. So but pretty quickly, as they get more and more critique from their readers, they pivot away from the Constantinople earthquake campaign in favor of an effort to rescue survivors of the Armenian massacres, who they then spend a lot of time talking about the consistency between that group of people and American Protestants who are concerned for religious liberty, for political self-determination, for autonomy. And they frame their relief effort as helping their brothers and sisters in Christ, as opposed to helping people regardless of their religious affiliation. And that chapter talks kind of at length about the strategies, sort of the competing strategies of what I call cosmopolitan charity and then tribal charity, which is more focused on helping those with whom we have things in common.
Now, you've alluded to this question and this issue of tensions between the American Red Cross and the relationship of the Christian Herald to the federal government. And I was wondering if you could tell us a little bit more about the chapter in which you discuss that.
Sure. So chapter 3 is called We Are Fighting for Philanthropy, and it analyzes the role of the Christian Herald in the U.S. government's efforts to alleviate suffering in Cuba leading up to the Spanish-American War. So as the crisis in Armenia really begins to subside, the Christian Herald starts to turn its attention to the ongoing debates that Americans are having about civilian suffering arising from the Cuban War of Independence. And there's an argument going on in the press about whether the government should take military action to assist insurgents in their fight against the Spanish colonizers, or whether the United States should maintain its longstanding policy of neutrality. And within this context, Klapsch and Talmadge propose what they see as a middle way, that providing humanitarian assistance to noncombatants in Cuba can offer an alternative to either military intervention or continued isolation. So they don't see it as, they see sort of maintaining isolation as morally problematic. How can the United States ignore the suffering? They've just actually been very critical of Europeans for not responding adequately to the suffering of Armenians. So they're arguing, Americans, this is in our own backyard. We can't ignore the suffering of Cubans who are being oppressed under Spanish rule. But we also don't, they're also have a longstanding tradition of pacifism, so they don't want to advocate war either. So here's their opportunity to say humanitarianism is the way that the United States should make itself present on the world stage, and it should be a different kind. The United States has an opportunity here to set an example for all nations of how to conduct humane international relations, Christian international relations. So with this argument, Klopsch succeeds in being appointed as a member of the State Department's Central Cuban Relief Committee, which is a committee of three people. So he really exercises a considerable authority over the procurement of relief supplies and distribution supplies after the State Department sets up this committee. And although this gives him a really powerful claim that the Christian Herald is at the forefront of the nation's official humanitarian operations, it's also the case that Clara Barton's nephew, Stephen Barton, is one of the other members of this three-person committee and is influential in having Clara Barton go to Cuba to be the one to help distribute the supplies that are sent by the committee. Klopsch decides to go to Cuba himself. And one of my favorite parts of the book is telling the story of this very public argument that they have when they meet in Cuba. The fight is quite dramatic. Clara Barton flies out of Cuba in a rush, goes back to the United States. The press picks up the story, and this is right also as the United States declares war. The Spanish-American War erupts. And so right at the same time, Klopsch is embarrassed by this fight that he has with Clara Barton. The United States no longer is maintaining this policy of Christian humanitarianism as the way to interact on the world stage. And this now the Christian Herald has to decide they're no longer at the forefront of humanitarianism. They're no longer, the United States is no longer maintaining a pacifist stance. So how are they going to respond now that the United States is engaging in war and quickly embroiled, not just in war with related to Cuba, but also involved in military actions in the Spanish colonies of Puerto Rico, Guam, Samoa, and the Philippines. And now what are they going to do? So that's part of the story that I trace in this third chapter.
Mm. So this next chapter, Almond Under the World, is interesting because in part it describes an interesting relationship of members of the Christian Herald and more broadly evangelical Christians in the U.S. towards sort of their counterparts elsewhere in the world. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah. So this chapter actually opens with, I should probably finish up the answer to how the Christian Herald responds to the Spanish-American War. And this is another example of a kind of pivot from framing the humanitarian project as one involving relief of suffering through in ways that will preserve peace, to broadening their definition of humanitarianism to include holy warfare on behalf of the afflicted. So once the United States declares war, Klopsch and Talmadge, rather than critiquing that decision, decide that this is actually an act of humanitarianism to come to the aid of the freedom fighters in Cuba, and then also to come to the aid of former Spanish colonized peoples in Puerto Rico, Guam, and the Philippines, and to sort of position the United States as a kind of benevolent liberator of suffering, subjugated people. They quickly receive critique for that position, not just from anti-imperialists that we know about, but also from within their own ranks. So one of their strongest critics is also a regular contributor to the newspaper, the evangelical minister Charles Sheldon, who some may know as the author of In His Steps, What Would Jesus Do? So that's that popular slogan that some Christians still appeal to. Sheldon was a prominent minister who regularly wrote for the Christian Herald and publicly accused the United States military of carrying out a repressive and vicious campaign in the Philippines. So that's how chapter four opens. So Klopsch and Talmadge are anxious because suddenly this vision that they had, that the Christian Herald was going to lead the American humanitarian mission in the world, that the United States was going to be a distinctive Christian nation on the world stage is undermined by American imperialism and evangelical critiques of it. So right at this moment, they also hear about massive famines going on in India through their missionaries. And they decide that the sort of way of recouping the United States' reputation on the world stage is to organize an effort to succor famine sufferers in the British Empire. So chapter four, and this ends up becoming the most successful humanitarian relief campaign in the Christian Herald's history. And chapter four talks about the various strategies that they use to elicit sympathy for India's famine victims, to reunite American evangelicals around this mission of claiming the United States' reputation as an almoner of the world. That's the title of the chapter. And then at the same time, the chapter looks at how, as aid is distributed through missionaries in India, there's also the involvement of local Christians and some of the tensions and concerns that come up about how it is that that American evangelicals are viewing Indian sufferers, and the way there's some pushback from Indians on the ground themselves about the way that they're depicted in the newspaper. So in some ways, the chapter's about the politics of representation. Particularly, it looks a lot at the Christian Herald was a real pioneer in humanitarian photography, in sort of depicting the suffering of others. And this is the chapter that sort of analyzes most heavily their innovations in journalism, in getting getting people to care about suffering elsewhere by using photography, and also sort of the ethical complications that come along with that practice.
What was also striking there is that one of the Indian Christians you describe, Pandita Ramabai, also has some issues with the United States and sort of its own issues, which you then go on to discuss in the next chapter, which is, and I love the title for this, The Limits of Evangelical Benevolence. Tell us a little bit about that.
So I end chapter four with a discussion of Pandita Ramabai, who's a fascinating character in her own right. And a number of historians have written about her as a reformer of women's education in India. And she's a major figure in the India famine. She had already established a school for widows and orphans, for widows in India prior to the famine. And during the famine, she expands her organization to become a shelter for famine widows and orphans. And within that context, she also is writing directly back to the Christian Herald and her other supporters in the United States to solicit aid. And she has her own voice, she has her own networks of support, and she uses those to not only raise aid, but to ask questions about the humanitarian project. And those include challenging the way that evangelicals like Clopton Talmadge present the United States. I think if readers listening to this look at the cover of my book, the image on the cover is called America, the Almoner of the World, and it's published in the Christian Herald right at the conclusion of the India famine campaign. And it depicts the United States as this kind of noble, magnanimous white savior of the sort of needy, dependent peoples of the world. And Ramabai herself, she doesn't directly critique this image, but she definitely has things to say about the United States not being as pure or as magnanimous as the Christian Herald and many American Protestants want to think. And some of her critiques include the fact that African Americans are not granted equal rights in the United States. It basically calls, like, the United States ideals are great, but they don't live up to them in the way that they're trying to present in pictures like the one on the cover of my book. So chapter five kind of takes up that critique and looks at not only Ramabai, but others who are calling the United States to its account for the way it treats minority groups, including African-Americans, including immigrants, particularly Asian immigrants, and Native Americans. And so, and it asks, it looks at the way the Christian Herald does or does not engage with communities outside of white American Protestantism. And this chapter I actually really owe to one of my friends at the Christian Herald Association, James Macklin, who originally invited me to come look at their archives and would sit with me while I was doing research. And he asked me this question, you know, what about African Americans? Where are they in your story? And it's on the one hand, it's quite true that the Christian Herald was very involved in efforts to organizations like Tuskegee or industrial education for African Americans throughout the South. So it's not that they weren't engaged in philanthropy, but it was a very particular kind of philanthropy. And they were much quieter about the kind of increasing violence against African Americans in the Jim Crow era. They don't talk about lynching. There are certain things that they don't. So there are some kinds of suffering that make the pages of the Christian Herald and some kinds of suffering that don't. And so his question, James Macklin's question to me, got me asking, why is it that certain kinds of suffering become part of their repertoire and others, they just remain completely quiet? So that's what happens. Those are the kinds of things I'm wrestling with in chapter five.
And I just had a quick question. I was struck reading that chapter. Does the Christian Herald have a relationship with any prominent African American churches?
So they, like, as I was saying, they have. They have a relationship with as many Protestant churches as they can. I mean, they want to be very inclusive, and they are regularly publishing profiles of African American ministers and philanthropists from the AME or the AMEZ. So, on the one hand, yes, they give voice to African American Christians, probably much more so than any other religious publication in this period that I could see, in the sense that many of the other religious, their competitors, were denominationally focused. So because the Christian Herald is interdenominational, they want to present American Protestantism as a unified community. And so, but they don't have formal relationships with African American churches. But it's also true that they don't have formal relationships with, traditionally white denominations. Does that make sense?
Yes, I think that does make sense. So then let's pivot on to the next chapter, to safeguard Christian America. What are they safeguarding here?
Right. So part of the concern, again, sort of leading off of chapter five, is that what they find is that a lot of the anxieties that are emerging because of increasing racial violence against African Americans, against Native Americans, as well as against Asian immigrants, Catholic immigrants, is leading to sort of a growing anxiety that the United States isn't actually living up to its Christian morality. On the one hand, so you've got critiques from people like Ramabai, Charles Sheldon, Ida B. Wells, Mark Twain, calling out the United States' failure to be just to all of the diverse communities that are part of its citizenry. And at the same time, you have you've got a lot of social change, right? That there are increasing numbers of diverse people coming into the United States. And originally, the Christian Herald has a lot of confidence that the United States can absorb these diverse communities, but it becomes increasingly clear that this is not going to be as easy as that they had hoped. So that's partly what chapter five is about. So chapter six looks at how the Christian Herald has to come to terms with a new United States and a variety of trends that are transforming the United States, not just socially, but also theologically, as well as some changes going on in debates about humanitarianism and philanthropy. So, so chapter six looks at, on the one hand, these kind of growing concerns. So one of the other important things that happens in the beginning of chapter six is that Talmage dies. And at that moment, he dies in 1902, and Christian Herald really loses its sort of public figurehead. Klopsch is the behind-the-scenes proprietor of the newspaper, but Talmage is the well-known, most popular minister of his day. And so that that's an important factor. At the same time, the American Red Cross, this is sort of post-clash with Clara Barton, is gaining prominence and increased support from the U.S. government. And then thirdly, this is also the period when proponents of more scientific forms of charity, or organized philanthropy, as it was called, are calling for a more professional approach to relief work. So as opposed to the Christian Herald's kind of grassroots, volunteer, working with missionaries way of doing humanitarianism, this is the beginning of the progressive era, where there's a call to, like, let's make charity a profession. Let's make charity more scientific. And newly formed charitable foundations sponsored by wealthy industrialists like Andrew Carnegie, Olivia Sage, and eventually Rockefeller begin to put their money behind this idea of modernizing charity. So all of that's going on in chapter six, and Klopsch is trying to, on his own, negotiate, on the one hand, increasing anxieties about immigration and racial violence, increasing tensions between capital and labor, increasing critiques of the millionaire class and industrial success in the United States. And so he's arguing, like, given the fact that the nation is going through this tumultuous period of change, it was more important than ever for the United States to maintain its face of Christian charity, right? That this was a way, we can't lose Christian America now. So he continues to try to have a lot of high profile overseas relief operations, as well as an ongoing effort to try to convince the government that the United States, or that the Christian Herald, should be at the vanguard of the United States humanitarian mission. And the chapter really charts the back and forth of those efforts. In some cases, the Christian Herald continues to show to outpace the Red Cross in terms of its fundraising ability. But as the Red Cross gets a new leader after Clara Barton resigns in the early 20th century, Mabel Boardman is quite successful in transitioning that organization into a much more organized, modern structure that partners successfully with the government. The Christian Herald has less less cachet. So that's part of the chapter. And then there are a couple other subplots going on where the Christian Herald starts to get involved in other kinds of campaigns, not just campaigns or debates about international relief work or poverty relief in the United States, but concern about things like the election of Senator Reed Smoot, a Mormon, to the U.S. Senate. Concerns about Theodore Roosevelt's decision to remove the motto "In God We Trust" from American money. And both of these, the decision of the New York School Board to not have Christmas celebrated in schools. And these are all signs for Klopsch and his colleagues at the Christian Herald that somehow Protestant America is losing its grip on the United States national identity. So the newspaper gets involved in campaigns to try to unseat Reed Smoot, which is unsuccessful, to restore "In God We Trust" to American money, which is successful. And over time, you can start to see the Christian Herald, as it's struggling to maintain itself at the forefront of American aid, getting involved in other kinds of campaigns that it sees as essential to maintaining a Christian identity for the United States.
Mm. So Klopsch dies in 1910. What happens to the Christian Herald because of this? And then sort of what's its fate going forward after 1910?
Right. So again, this is losing Talmage in 1902 is a real blow. And by the death of Klopsch in March of 1910 is a real turning point for the newspaper. In 1910, the same week that Klopsch dies, two things happen. One is that the Rockefeller files a charter for the Rockefeller Foundation to become this sort of huge tax shelter philanthropic organization. And the first edition of the Fundamentals, which become the sort of touchstone text for the fundamentalist movement, is published. So I kind of look at March 1910 as this pivotal month where many of the things in which the Christian Herald has tried to hold the center of American evangelical Protestantism and the United States as a Christian nation led by evangelical charities start to unravel. So Klopsch has worked for two decades by now to create this cohesive community of Christian believers who are committed to the shared mission of alleviating distress around the world. But finally, these centrifugal energies that I was describing before, sort of theological tensions, really begin to pull Protestants in divergent directions. So this is the period where debates between the fundamentalist and those that they call Protestant modernist become more intense. And one of the features of that debate is precisely about the role of charity within Christian practice. Should Christians spend energy and resources devoted to alleviating poverty or disaster relief, or is their primary mission to preach the gospel? So that's not an entirely new debate by 1910, but it becomes increasingly rancorous during this period. And so the Christian Herald, it had never really been a subject of much conversation, but you start to see during this time period after Klopsch's death, more concern about whether or not what the Christian Herald's doing is really a primary way that Christians should be acting in the world. At the same time, controversy over the spread of Pentecostal revivals, and particularly this practice of ecstatic religious experiences like speaking in tongues, is starting to rupture the evangelical community throughout the United States and in other regions as well. And so that up until that time, holiness Christians had been very much a part of the Christian Herald's readership. And during this period, denominations begin to split over Pentecostalism, and new denominations form that sort of draw readers away from this coalition that Klopsch had tried to create. And so on the one hand, you've got these internal tensions destabilizing evangelical solidarity. And at the same time, you've got sort of an increasing consolidation of this movement towards large-scale, scientific, modernized, professionalized charity. And as the Rockefeller Foundation eventually receives approval for its charter, the Olivia Sage Foundation, the Carnegie Foundation, they all increasingly support this movement towards a much larger scale form of philanthropy that eventually partners with the U.S. government. So those foundations also eventually begin to support the work of the American Red Cross, which by now has become really like a semi-official arm of the United States government. And by the time of World War II, the ARC is carrying out a lot of the civilian relief work of the United States in Europe. And the Christian Herald is also still conducting some relief campaigns in the war, but after the World War I, it really begins to shift its focus to maintaining some of its domestic charities like the Bowery Mission, which still exists today, but also devoting more and more of its pages towards things like promoting Protestant piety and spirituality.
So are there lessons that we can apply from the Christian Herald to today's humanitarian crisis? Because these issues that they're facing have not disappeared for us, both domestic and internationally.
Yeah. So I talk a lot about this in the epilogue of the book. What are the lessons of the book overall? And it's certainly true that during the period that I was researching the book, I spent a lot of time at the Christian Herald headquarters. That's the only place where copies of the newspaper existed up until my research, we were able to digitize and preserve some of them. But one of the great things about the research process is that I had a lot of opportunity to talk with people who are still working at this organization. And you're right that many of the kinds of questions that I found Klopsch and Talmage and their missionaries and their colleagues wrestling with are still questions that folks working at the Christian Herald are struggling with today. So things like, does philanthropy create dependency? Should we get involved in relieving the immediate needs of suffering people, or should we be investing in longer term structural solutions? How can we get people to care about suffering of others? Should we be using the kinds of iconography that the Christian Herald pioneered, where you're picturing suffering people as in need of the help of those who are quote unquote more fortunate? So all of those things, I think, are still prescient today. And I think I don't know that I feel like there's clear lessons of like, here's how Klopsch and Talmage did it, and here's how we should apply, or here's the ways that, you know, they made some mistakes, and these are mistakes that we could avoid. I think one of the goals that I had in the book was to look at the ways that humanitarianism and philanthropy, these efforts to help suffering others, the efforts to make the world a better place, to do good by others, is really entangled for them in ways that they may not have even realized with all kinds of other agendas, right? Economic ambitions, nationalist visions, political agendas, racial prejudices, gendered suppositions, and to sort of make visible the kinds of forces that impinged on their efforts to live out their faith as Christians, and then to ask, are there ways that contemporary philanthropists or anyone that's trying to help others make the world a better place, what are our own blind spots? Can we use their experience to try to think through how our own efforts to make the world better are also entangled with all kinds of things that we may not realize? So that was one of the most important, I think, lessons for me as a takeaway from the book. Maybe a little bit more of a pedantic one that I thought was really interesting to look at the tension between the Christian Herald and the Red Cross, and to look at the tension between a form of philanthropy that was grassroots, volunteer, driven by religious convictions, to one that was federalized, large scale, professionalized, and what are those different models tell us, right? So one of the arguments that Klopsch always had with Clara Barton was that it was much more efficient and effective to partner, to collect resources and then partner with local people to distribute them, as opposed to sending over American professionals to do the job. And I think that seems to be, I mean, I'm not an expert in contemporary humanitarian aid, but it does seem to be a lesson that was absorbed over the course of the 20th century, right? That humanitarian organizations now tend to have local employees that aren't Americans necessarily sent over to deliver aid, but they're working with people who know the context, know the language, know the needs on the ground in a way that's different from an American aid worker. Mm. So I thought that was it was just interesting to see that debate how it's still a prescient one, even though maybe it's been worked out a little bit more fully. The other thing I'll just mention is that I did write a blog post recently about the ongoing challenges of depicting suffering. I wrote a post about the viral photograph of the Syrian toddler Alan Kurdi that washed up on shore in Turkey of September 2015, and how that photograph resulted in kind of a wave of outpouring sympathy for the Syrian refugee crisis, but just raised a lot of questions about the ethics of representing suffering. And I think that that's an issue that's still with us. It's certainly effective to represent suffering in a certain way, but what are the consequences of doing that? Mm-hmm. So those are some of the kinds of things that I hope, I'm not sure again that these are lessons, but they're questions that are questions that I hope will provoke conversation for people who are involved in humanitarian relief or philanthropy in the present.
Wonderful. We're just about the end of our time here. So I just wanted to ask, and I know you're just coming off of a book project, so maybe you don't want to think about it yet. What do you want to work on next?
Well, there are so many stories that came. I mean, but when I started the conversation, I mentioned that I started with this huge project and I ended up getting fascinated by the story of this one newspaper and its leaders as a way of getting out at these bigger issues. So this is really kind of a micro history, right, that gets at much larger issues. And it worked really well because the Christian Herald involves and solicited stories from all kinds of religious organizations, from the Salvation Army to the YMCA to the Women's Christian Temperance Union, to missionaries, to industrial education and institutes throughout the American South. So there are a lot of stories that came up in this research that I didn't get to follow through on. And some of the ones that interest me most are, you know, this book talks a lot about the presentation of the United States as a Christian nation in a particular kind of way. But as we've been discussing, there's also places throughout the book where you can see people who are living with that idea, but also trying to live against it and beyond it. So someone like Pandita Ramabai, right, or someone like Charles Sheldon. And so the stories of those folks who are living what I would say, I'm borrowing language from Robert Orsi, kind of in, with, through, and against a certain kind of American imperial and capitalist expansionism. I'm interested in looking at those stories and how it is that people lived in, with, through, against, and then I would add beyond those kinds of structures that are becoming increasingly prescient at this time. So imperialism, capitalism, and also racism. So I have a few stories that I'm trying to decide whether I'm just going to focus on one or whether I'm going to try to weave together some of the stories of someone like Pandita Ramabai with Charles Sheldon, with Amanda Berry Smith, to look at how they're creating networks that are pushing forward something distinctive in this time period. So that's what I'm thinking. I haven't actually made any decisions just yet.
Wonderful. Well, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us today.
Thank you for having me. I really appreciate the chance to talk about the book.